welcome to the Board of Public Works. We've got a lot of work to do today, so I'm going to get right to it. And I just turn it over to my colleagues for any brief opening remarks. Madam Treasurer?
Governor, I wouldn't want this meeting to pass without recognizing the tragic and quite shocking passing of my colleague, Kevin Kemenetz, who was a really driving and dedicated force in Maryland. I know you both have spoken. I was out of town and couldn't be at the service, but I want to add my voice. I've worked with Kevin since he was on the county council, actually in school construction, but in a number of different things. And rarely have I found somebody who was so continuously driving and dedicated and quite brilliant, I think. And he will be a great loss to the entire
state.
And missing.
Thank you for mentioning that. And, we were at the funeral, and it was where our hearts are with Kevin's family, his two sons, and his wife, Jill. I also want to send my prayers out to Anthony Brown, who suffered a stroke leaving that funeral, which is just unbelievable. But I think he's doing pretty well, so thank you for being there.
Yes, I completely agree with the treasurer and the governor, and my sympathies go to Jill, Kemenetz's wife, and his two children. I have to admit at the funeral that I thought Mrs. Kemenetz gave a brilliant statement. I'm not sure how she was able to do it, but I hope, not that I want to pass away anytime soon, but I hope my wife says the same things that she said, because her favorite, her best comment, I thought, was if Kevin were here, he would be walking around with the Baltimore Sun saying, look at all the positive press I'm getting. But it was a huge loss, obviously, and a shock. And I just want to give my very strong personal regards to Jill Kemenetz and to Carson and Dylan. They both spoke also. And I'm sure that they have a tremendous amount of support and will get through this. And anything that obviously we in political circles can do for them, we would like to. And, there's no sugarcoating this. I didn't agree with it. County executive on many, many issues, and that's okay. He was, as the treasurer said, he was a hard-charging, strong-willed individual, and but I salute him for his advocacy and his legacy of public service. On a happier note, I'm going to the Caps game tomorrow.
Maybe happy.
Oh, yeah, this Born to Sorrow team is now headed for the Stanley Cup. But they've got to get a few wins under their belt. And my daughter, who's a big fan, is coming down from New York City. And my Mother's Day gift to her was to, take out a new loan on my house and buy a couple of tickets. Governor, thank you for the everything that you're representing these days. And I agree about Congressman Brown. I'm going to try to call him today and just ask him how he's doing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're going to start with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Just a moment on Kevin. When I moved to Baltimore when I was 17 years old, one of the first two people I met was Kevin. He was 18. And so I used to see him come in here as Baltimore County Executive, and all I could ever remember was this skinny kid with a mustache at 18. And Bruce Spector was the other one, Alan and Ricky Spector's son. Those were the two first I met when I moved to Baltimore. So anyway, I wanted to remember Yolanda Winkler and other people who knew Kevin as a friend and are, very sad because their friend died. So we have 11 items on the Secretary's agenda this morning. We have two reports of emergency procurement. Item 11 is a hand-carried item.
I'd just like to bring up item 2. This is a request from the judiciary to eliminate certain fees and then to adopt new fees. And we've been focused on trying to put money back into the pockets of hardworking Maryland families. small businesses and retirees, which is exactly what we said we would do. We've reduced or eliminated more than 250 fees, and combined with tax and toll reductions, we put $1.2 billion back into the pockets of Marylanders. So I'm opposed to creating new fees or increasing fees, regardless of which branch of government tries to impose them. So I want to pull out item two for separate votes on both the fee eliminations and then another one on the proposed new fees. And I would make a motion to approve the proposed elimination fees of fees. Is there a second on that?
Second.
Vote is 3-0. And then I would make a motion against the proposed new fees. Is there a second for that?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
So
no.
The motion carries 2-0. Are there any other questions on the
No, I think it was 2-1.
I'm sorry. 2-0. I didn't mean to discount you at all. It was a very strong no vote. Treasurer, that I failed to recognize it's a 2-1 vote. I'm just so used to saying 3-0. We get along so well and agree on almost everything. Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Governor, I would just like to point out there are three things, actually, that Mr. Berman has pointed out that struck me also. The Secretary's item number 10, the wetlands license, and also going on to the DNR items, but I'll mention them now if I could, 1 and 2, just to show how we can combine both good conservation projects and environmental protection projects. And I just want to thank and commend all of you who are doing that. It's a win-win. Thank you.
So is there a motion on...
I have a question, actually, on item 8-9. I think Mr. Berman, is that Paul Berman?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Paul Berman is a retired Covington & Burling lawyer. That's a law firm that I could, as a young lawyer, never even get in the door to because they're so elite and big legacy in Washington for that firm. But Mr. Berman is... lives in Montgomery County, and he's very interested in procurement reform being put, as the treasurer said, being put in sync with environmental protection, particularly climate control. So I want to thank Paul personally. Maybe he can stand up. So is he here? He's not here. Oh, good. And then I had on items 8 and 9, I just wanted to pull those out, and there's Bob Gorrell here?
Yes, he is. Mr. Gorrell is coming up now.
Good morning.
Can you just help us understand what we're doing here?
Yes.
Where did these funds come from? How long have they been in local jurisdictions? And what are we doing here?
This is item number 9. Yes, these are... funds that have not been allocated at this point. These are projects that are eligible, and this would allocate those remaining funds.
Okay. So my understanding is that these funds, many of them have been around since 2011. These are funds from the alcohol tax that went to the schools. Frankly, it's kind of ironic that we're looking at these small amount of funds on what should be the Board of Public Works meeting where we are asked to approve the final public school construction capital improvement plan for fiscal year 2019 in the full light of the day, providing an opportunity for county executives, members of the legislature, and most importantly, members of the public to observe this state funding process being conducted in a transparent way. But in the typical Annapolis fashion in vogue these days downstairs, a last-minute amendment inserted into the capital budget by the conference committee states that IAC decisions made somewhere out of the public sight are final and shall not be the subject for approval by the Board of Public Works. Takes away a huge amount of accountability and transparency and openness for $392 million in taxpayer dollars. And with Baltimore City and Baltimore County's well-publicized challenges with providing and maintaining climate-controlled classrooms, it seems to me that we should be increasing in the state of Maryland, not decreasing, the oversight over the way school construction funds are spent. Much to my dismay, just 2 days after we were here, our last meeting, discussing the stifling heat in Baltimore City classrooms, I was pained to read in the newspaper that a child passed out in Baltimore City at Windsor Hills Elementary School in West Baltimore amid a third day of 90-degree heat. Student left school. Should be a place of learning and well-being and good health in an ambulance. I was shocked to learn that Windsor Hills is a school that actually does have a climate control system in place. The state has made multiple investments to update HVAC systems over the past 10 years, including a cooling tower replacement and a chiller replacement. So, Mr. Gorrell, if you could just perhaps comment on the failure of cool air reaching at least that particular classroom.
Yes, that was a portion of the school, and it appears, doing the forensics on what had occurred, is the cooling coils that take the heat from the classroom and put it into the air. The ambient air were dirty, and they couldn't do the transfer. So the compressors that were well maintained were not able to dump the heat from the classroom. It overloaded and shut down.
Okay, I see that's not good.
No.
I see that vertical package classroom air conditioning units are included. I support that. I think we had a little show and tell with some of the equipment units that are similar to that, are included in the 2019 capital improvement program, which the IAC will be asked to approve on May 31st. Would these units both cool and heat all the classrooms, as well as provide increased HVAC controls?
Yes, they will, and it limits the risk. That was 4 classrooms that were lost at Windsor Hills. That limits the risk, actually, so only 1 classroom could shut down. Possibly you could move the students to classrooms that did have heating and cooling.
Okay, so I understand there are 9 schools that have been funded for that vertical package air conditioning units, and there are another 9 that are in the 2019 capital improvement program.
That's right, and they've made really good progress, actually. Their project management, to be able to line the projects up and keep them moving, I'm pleased.
Okay. I bring these issues up because I happen to believe that there are hundreds of classrooms in Baltimore City and in Baltimore County that, for whatever reason, over the years, could actually be cooled and warmed appropriately, using these vertical package classroom air conditioning units, and they need to be put in sooner rather than later. And, Governor, I happen to think that these are the types of questions that deserve to be asked in an open, transparent forum. And once again, as long as I serve as a member of this board, these types of questions will continue to be asked. I'm going to ask Mr. Gorrell to give us an up-to-date list of every single classroom in Baltimore County and Baltimore City that, as of this date, lacks air conditioning and, looking back to the winter, heating during the cold months. How many classrooms are there? Not schools, not, gee, they're planning to be here, gee, we're going to get around to it by 2020 or something. How many right now? Because the hot weather obviously was with us briefly, and it's going to return.
Yes, Mr. Controller, we'll do
so
that.
If you could get that to me and share it with my colleagues, and also suggest that perhaps down the road we get the school systems. Hats off to Baltimore City if they're, in fact, moving forward on these units. But I want to be kept informed about, are they actually – are the promises being kept? Is the equipment actually being installed?
We can put that together and continually advise you.
Thank you very much.
Just on this, his first opening question about the money being there since 2011, is that correct?
I have not done the research to see why they sat, whether they were reverted funds, projects didn't come forward, and so they came back and had to be reallocated, but I can determine that and send you a report on that as well.
Great.
Yes, they were allocated in 2011, and we handed them to the local jurisdictions, and they could have air-conditioned every classroom in Baltimore City and Baltimore County with that money. They chose to spend it on lighting at a stage and paving something somewhere. It turned into just a anything but taking care of the kids.
I knew we were going to go through this every meeting, and I recognize it and I get it. To say that they don't care about the kids in the Baltimore City schools, I think, is a step too far. The question of efficient use, as you will recall, Mr. Garrels, and I'm sort of surprised you didn't mention it, there's been a change now in the way funds are allowed by the IAC to be used. Is that not right?
Yes, that is.
There was a clear misunderstanding before about whether funds could be used.
Yes, Madam Treasurer. The IAC had limited the funds to projects over a threshold. We recognize that hobbled some good solutions where we can link projects together and do multiple projects of similar types, and that has occurred, and we are moving forward. And
but that was definitely a positive step, which we pushed hard to make sure happened. We're glad we're making progress.
Yes.
I don't want to point fingers about why things aren't happening, who did what, but I do share the comptroller's concern that we still have tens of thousands of students that are, you know, don't have heat or air conditioning in their classrooms. And after hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in state tax dollars and having record funding, the most funding in school construction in a decade and record funding 4 years in a row, we put $25 million into schools since I've been governor. Why we can't get classrooms air conditioned, it is pretty frustrating.
Mr. Governor, I agree with that, and there are sufficiency standards the IAC has been working on that will allow us to measure every school in the state and understand what is the root cause behind all of these things.
Yeah. The Treasurer corrected me. It was $25 billion, not $25 million.
Yeah, and if you're talking to some local officials, tell them to contact the family of that young boy that was hauled off in an ambulance because of the 90-plus heat in his classroom.
Okay.
Maybe find that gentleman, that teacher that was legitimately famous because of his YouTube where he was teaching a class with his parka on, asking why. And, we all, I guess, rhetorically care about the kids. What about some results?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, unfortunately... some of the decisions that have been made by the legislature, and they overrode several of our vetoes, made us the second least accountable school system in America, and that's frustrating to us. But I appreciate your efforts at the IAC, and we're going to continue to push to get some more accountability with our local school system.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just for the record, that is not a statement in which we all concur. Again.
I wasn't the one that came up with it. It was federal government.
Whomever.
Thank you.
We have quite accountable systems.
It was the Obama administration that decided that.
Whomever.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the secretary's agenda?
Yes. A2.
All right. That is an emergency report from the Department of Transportation Secretary.
Yeah, I'm going to bring that up. We're going to get a report. Yes.
Maryland Department of Transportation, Maryland Transit Administration.
Yes, so Mr. Secretary, shutting down this report apparently from MTA concerns emergency procurement that the agency needed to make necessary repairs to the Baltimore Metro subway link system back in, I believe it was February or earlier this year. Shutting down Baltimore Metro at less than 24 hours' notice obviously caused tremendous disruption and inconvenience to 34,000 commuters, including 6,000 students who rely daily on this system. According to MTA, the conditions that existed in the Baltimore Metro subway posed a serious threat to the public's health, safety, and welfare. And now that the necessary repairs have been completed, I was wondering if you could just identify what the issues were and assure us that the defects are adequately repaired. And I see you have a very important colleague here as to what the status is.
Yes, Mr. Comptroller, we have put a great deal of effort into understanding what caused this circumstance and how to make sure that doesn't happen again, but to make sure that you're getting the information that is absolutely most up to date. We have Mr. Quinn with us today, who's the administrator of the MTA.
So what was the problem and how was it corrected?
Sure. So, good morning.
First of all, good morning, Mr. Quinn.
Good morning. Get right to it. Our metro system, just some quick background, is 36 years old this year, and so we're regularly doing a lot of routine repair. A lot of legacy cities around the country are in this situation. So a few years ago, we put money in the budget to do some rail replacement work on the metro subway system that was planned for this summer. In anticipation of that summer rail replacement, we sent in January an inspector out to check out the rail, see how it was doing. And what the inspector came back with was that rail had worn sooner than we expected. And so that information was presented to me on Thursday, February 8th, and we made a quick decision out of an abundance of caution to close the system down. And we did that for that Friday, Saturday, Sunday, while we could conduct additional inspections. We did that. We verified the inspector's results and proceeded to have a multi-week shutdown while we did those rail replacement and repairs. It was an inconvenience to a lot of riders. You were exactly right. I felt it, believe me. And that night, that Thursday night, I personally called all the major media outlets and did telephone interviews, on the air telephone interviews. We hit social media as hard as we could. We did as much as we could to get the word out. And that Monday, that first Monday, within 24 hours, we put in place a bus bridge. We had an express and a local bus bridge to really help people get to work and give them options.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is a continuing problem in cities around the country with these legacy systems with. We haven't done the preventive maintenance, and it hadn't been fixed for 30 years. The Washington Metro was exactly the same problem that we're faced with. But I it was terribly inconvenient, and it was a lot of people were, it really caused a problem. But I want to thank you for your quick response. And, look, it could have been a tragic situation where we didn't check the rails and or we didn't shut it down, and we could have had, people injured or killed with the train going off the track. So. It was a bad situation, but it could have been much worse, and I want to thank you for your leadership.
Thank you.
Actually, he said it better than...
Yeah.
are we taking advantage of lessons learned from Metro or New York or all these other...
It's a great question. So very soon after the shutdown, we contacted the American Public Transportation Association, APTA, and we requested an APTA peer review. That's ongoing right now, and once we get that report, we'll look to move forward on those recommendations. But they bring in folks from all across the country that are in, the rail, industry to come and give us recommendations. It's a fantastic process. But, Mr. Governor, your comments are well taken. Safety for the Maryland Department of Transportation is always going to be paramount for us, and I think we made some quick, decisive choices that were the right ones.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Move approval.
Is there a second?
Second.
3-0 on the Secretary's agenda. We're going to move on to real property, the DNR.
Good morning to the esteemed board. I appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you. Secretary Belton is at a conference this morning, but he sends his regards. For the record, my name is Joanne Throw. I'm Deputy Secretary for the Department of Natural Resources. Today we have 5 items on the agenda, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions on DNR?
I'll need to reiterate what I said earlier.
And I want to thank you for those comments.
Great.
It's appreciated.
Do we have a motion on the DNR?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Up next, the Department of Budget and Management. Secretary.
Good morning. I'm David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, we've brought 14 items for your consideration. 14 GM is supplemental, and I have representatives here to address any concerns you might have.
I want to just make a comment about items 3 and 4. These are contracts for leasing minivans and passenger vans to transport Maryland Conservation Job Corps participants to our state parks. Last year, this came in as a as a single bid item, and we were kind of frustrated with that. But I want to applaud the DNR and the DBM teams both for working to generate competitive bids this time on these contracts, which I think is good for the taxpayer. So thank you for that. I also see MDE Secretary Ben Grumbles is here for another item, but I would like to have him come up and maybe give us an update on the runoff issue at the Four Seasons project on Kent Island, if we could.
Thank you, Governor, Comptroller, Treasurer. I'd just like to say Secretary Belton is not only at a conference. He's at the Greenports Congress this morning. And Governor, that is the first of its kind where Maryland is hosting an international Greenports conference. So ports around the world are convening in Baltimore to learn what the Maryland Port Administration is doing and what the state of Maryland is doing to protect our ports and move forward in an environmentally responsible way.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. And I did a video welcoming them all and congratulating them on their work because I had to be here to do this meeting instead.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Maryland Department of Transportation, with undying support and affection from the Maryland Department of the Environment. An update on the Four Seasons project. As you know, there was an unfortunate and unacceptable event that occurred several months ago, contributing to water pollution of our treasured Chesapeake Bay. The Maryland Department of the Environment visited the site immediately. We've also done so with local authorities, and I'm pleased to say that as of last night, we've reached an agreement, an important enforcement agreement, where Cahove Navian will be paying $30,000 as a cash payment, a penalty, if you will, and also making a strong commitment, an ironclad commitment, to provide additional treatment for sediment-laden runoff from the site. As they continue to follow the permitting rules and requirements and move from a sediment basin to a runoff pond, a stormwater runoff pond, using vegetation and other measures. So this is a positive side to an unfortunate event, a silver lining to a dark cloud, where we have an additional commitment from Cahove Navian, we have a penalty, and we're sending a strong signal to the construction industry that Maryland will hold those accountable and will expect not only to meet minimum standards, but investments to deal with extreme weather, which requires extremely good planning and contingency planning. So that is the update on the settlement. We have an enforcement settlement with Cahove Navian, which is significant and involves real dollars and real investment to prevent pollution.
Well, Secretary Grumbles, I appreciate your efforts in staying on top of this. Obviously, we've had some extreme weather the past few days and flooding in a number of places, so we want to continue to be vigilant. And even if people are trying to do the right thing, we've got to stay on top of them and make sure that we are not letting runoff like this get into the bay.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to thank Secretary Grumbles also because you treated this matter seriously, as it should be. It was unacceptable, and I reminded you of their Hovnanian's lawyer standing right where you are years ago when I asked whether there will be any runoff problems, and he said, none whatsoever. Scout's honor. That was his statement. And I remind him of that every time I see him around Annapolis because this type of pollution is unacceptable. Frankly, I don't think the sprawl development should ever have been permitted out there, but that's not you. You had the responsibility to work out an agreement, and I appreciate the result that you have come up with. And I just want to say that to the governor and to his environment secretary, it's a good result.
Thank you.
I assume you're going to keep monitoring it.
Absolutely.
It's a good assumption.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Governor, can we take advantage of Ben being there?
I wouldn't take advantage of it. Yeah, we can ask him a few questions.
Yes. This is 5S, the renewable portfolio standards item. Can you just tell us a little bit about what the company will be doing and what the time frame is and what we can do to support?
I will take advantage of Joanne Throw, who for DNR oversees the effort with the PPRP.
Thank you. Great question. And actually, we brought
Thank
a couple
you,
of our colleagues here. We've got Bruce Michael, who is the director of the Resource Assessment Service, and he has particular details on that. And Susan Gray is with us as well with the PPRP program.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'd like to introduce Susan Gray, and she is our deputy director for the Power Plant Research Program and actually the project manager for this particular project. And so if you have a specific question on the project itself, I'd like to entertain that.
I would just like to know what to anticipate with this group doing this. I have no problem with it at all. I'm quite supportive of it. I just want you to tell us a little bit about it, including the time frame and, as I said before, what the Board of Public Works can do to help boost Maryland's increased use of renewable.
A little bit of vertical challenge here. Sorry about that. Let me tell you, I'm Susan Gray, and let me tell you a little bit about what the RPS study is all about. We were directed by the General Assembly in their 2017 session to conduct basically a soup-to-nuts kind of look at the Maryland RPS. The RPS has been around for a long time now and has been changed, gosh, more than 10 times, I believe, along the way. In particular, the bill, HB 1414, directed the Power Plant Research Program to look at the environmental consequences of what's going on with renewables as well as the socioeconomics that included environmental justice, to look at ratepayer impacts, to also look at what renewables may or may not have a future with regard to the RPS. Clean energy, which includes nuclear power, was added to the study, as well as many other factors as well.
Okay. Could I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm probably going to vote against this, much as I am in favor of renewable energy. Why? It's a single bid contract.
Well, actually, we had two bidders, but one bidder was deemed not susceptible for contract award.
Okay. What contract terms did the second bidder refuse to accept?
Well, basically, this particular bidder had exceptions to almost every term and condition within the standard contract.
Yeah, so that's not a responsive bid. So we have one bid, and I obviously support the subject matter of what you're talking about, and I'm not interested in not doing what the legislature wants, but the fact of the matter is it's a single bid. The governor and the treasurer and I have dramatically reduced single bid contracts. 2013, there were 82 of them. Last year, there were 38. There are five single bid contracts on this agenda. You're the first one that's come up. And I just don't get it. Why, for $785,000, you couldn't get two valid bids to assure the taxpayers that we're getting a good deal?
Well, in the past, the Power Plant Research Program has faced this challenge many times. And what we found over the years is that there is a very, very limited pool of contractors who can do utility economics or who specialize in utility economics, and particularly those associated with the power generation sector. So, in addition, most of that limited pool is utilized by others, such as the Public Service Commission and the utilities themselves.
I understand this group is a good group. I'm not having any problem with them. They also have a single bid contract from DNR, I believe. All I'm saying is we have today five single bids on the agenda today. We've only had six single bid contracts since January, total, all of our meetings. And I applaud the governor and the treasurer because I think the only way to really deal with this situation is to begin turning down the single bid contracts that are not essential and from which no harm would really evidence itself as far as the public, because otherwise they just begin to creep back up. I could not thank the governor and the treasurer more for being supportive of this. They don't need to be supportive even with me today. But I do believe that the only solution to this issue of single bid contracts is to say no, where possible. And this is an instance. I guess here's my final question. What bad things would happen if we asked you to go out and get a competitive bid?
Well, it would take many months to go back and do another competitive bid. The legislature tasked us to be able to provide them with an interim report on December 1st, 2018. We would not be able to submit that interim report. The final report is due to the legislature and the governor on December 1st, 2019, and I do not believe that we would be able to meet either one of those milestones.
I happen to have a lot of confidence you guys could accomplish that, but that's I'm not obviously part of your agency. But
and you think the reason for the lack of bids is simply that it's such a specific task that there's only one company that can possibly do it?
Well, there's probably a handful of companies. But in particularly, they also work for, you know, BGE, Pepco, the other utilities, as well as the Public Service Commission. And typically from the private industry sector, they are often able to charge much higher labor rates than we could. So, yes, sir, I believe that this is the reason for the single bid.
Because, you know, all of us share the concern about single bids, but we understand that occasionally there's a circumstance that prohibits that from happening. This is we've got a time frame to deal with, and if there's not the expertise out there, do you think it would just delay things for months and we'd still have another bid, one single bid come in? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So, I mean, I totally agree
no,
with the controller.
No, I welcome the opportunity to agree with the governor on some issues from time to time. But I just happen to believe this is something that we need to hold in mind. And I know it's inconvenient. It doesn't sound like I'm going to have prevail on the vote, but I'm planting my flag saying this is what we need to do more of.
So I think, Comptroller, you want to make a motion to pull this out from
please,
the...
Please, if I could, to get a separate vote on this, and then happy to approve the rest of the agenda.
I'll second your motion to pull it out for a second vote.
And then I'll move to reject it or ask them to go back and find a legitimate second competitive bid. And
I think that motion may die for lack of a second.
My feelings are not hurt. I'm happy to make a point.
Yeah,
and
thank
we
you.
Will continue to look at anything that we can do to help get multiple bids on these projects, but it is very difficult, and we're making every effort that we possibly can.
Well, we have four other single bid contracts coming after you, so we'll take a look at those.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting to hear, but it can come afterwards, what the time frame is.
The time frame for the study is that we owe the governor and the General Assembly an interim report.
No, I understand that, right. But how it will roll out before the interim report and then before. Will we see anything, or are there any milestones between now and the end of the calendar year?
Not in the legislative mandate for us to do the study.
I'm not asking that.
I guess I'm not clear.
You're our department. You're the legislature.
So let me make sure I do understand your question. You're asking.
What do you anticipate happening between now and the end of the year?
That's an excellent question. We actually have a work group that is made up of utilities. The other agencies, MEA, the PSC, are all on this work group. We are planning to have our first meeting, face-to-face meeting, next month in June. And we will follow with that. We're going to have a website with the information up available, and all that will be available for the public and
so we will be able to see as this goes on how
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the webpage is already up on the website.
Great.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other?
Is there a motion to approve 5S separately? Because I believe the comptroller.
That motion.
No, but do you want to approve it, or are you just going to approve it along with the whole agenda? And ordinarily, if the comptroller is going to register dissent, we would take a separate vote to approve this.
Well, I'd like to make a motion that
to
we approve
this item.
Second.
And so that passes 2-1.
All right. So 5S is taken care of. We have the rest of the DVM agenda.
Yeah. So is there a motion on the remainder of the DVM agenda?
One more question.
Sorry.
This is the one I honestly thought. I think I was asking the secretary. Reggie.
That was number
that was it.
7, right?
Well, we got the right guy to come back then.
Just all the progress Maryland is making with Reggie.
Well, first of all, Governor, Treasurer, Comptroller, Reggie is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and with the governor's leadership, we're trying to also make it become MAGGIE, the Mid-Atlantic Greenhouse Gas Initiative, by adding in Virginia and New Jersey back into the program. But it is currently, is about to celebrate its 10th anniversary. It's the 9-state program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector. And for Maryland, this is translated into about over $600 million in revenue that goes into the Strategic Energy Investment Fund and $2.9 billion for the region of the states that are part of REGGIE. And just as importantly, in fact, from my perspective, more importantly, we have seen emissions of greenhouse gases from the power plant sector slashed in half. And that's due to REGGIE and weather and other important decisions towards renewable energy and energy efficiency. So I'm just appearing before you to say that REGGIE is working very well. It's a powerful example of a way for the states that are part of REGGIE, now 9 states, perhaps 11 over the next year, to reduce emissions from the power sector, transition to cleaner energy sources, and provide a revenue for not only energy efficiency and energy conservation, but for renewable energy and for consumer or direct ratepayer assistance up to a point.
Well, let me say, I'm proud that our state is the leader of REGGIE, and it's a really great thing, and I look forward to New Jersey being fully active and Virginia joining in, and then we can reach across the country.
We're going through the very complicated and tedious rules of what is a proper cap for a state and the different program elements, and I appreciate the question because we too are very proud. And it fits right into the state's greenhouse gas reduction plan and transition to a cleaner economy.
Thank you very much for your leadership on this issue, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you.
We're really proud of the not only REGGIE, but everything we're doing with respect to clean air. We have clean air standards stronger than 48 other states and twice as strong as the Paris Accord, and we are national leaders on this issue. And I want to thank you for making it happen.
Thank you.
Now is there a motion to approve the remainder of the agenda? Second, 3-0.
Thank you.
Now we're going to move on, I believe, to the university system agenda.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 4 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
Any questions on the university system? There's a motion. Second. Mr. Evans,
Thank you.
A nice day.
3-0. Yeah, they can play field hockey at Towson University,
yes. Move on to information technology.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I'm Michael Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 4 items on our agenda, and I do have agency representatives available to answer any questions you may have.
Questions on information technology?
I did have a question. I think. I hate to keep raising this, but on item number 4, the MDOT contract with IBM, 1-year contract, we keep running into these essentially legacy contracts. We know we're going to continue. They're 1 year. I have a feeling that we are jerked around by the state, by this corporation. Is there anything we can do to come together and be a bigger counterweight to a huge corporation and get some better terms? The comptroller got, as I recall, a 2-year contract.
That's right, and frankly, we're not in much of a position to know what the opportunity is to combine different departments, but I can tell you that we want to get off of the mainframe. And so we have two of our systems that are currently on the mainframe that within the next 2 years should come off. But then it leaves FEMIS. It will be, in essence, the last program on the mainframe. And that's an awfully big, bite to get us into a different system from where we are on FEMIS.
It's a great corporation, IBM, but it was a great corporation 20 years ago when we got into these situations where we're essentially held hostage.
We are. I mean, we have no choice. We have to go to IBM for their proprietary
system. Well, if there's anything we can do, enterprise, the whole state of Maryland, enterprise-wise.
Well, in fact, Madam Treasurer, we are working hand-in-hand with all 31 of the executive agencies that, in fact, have numerous discussions with the comptroller's office and, indeed, with yours. There are many opportunities that I think we will be able to avail ourselves of with regard to utilizing off-premise computing and cloud computing in the next 2 years. And one of the goals that you'll see in our next master plan is indeed the incorporation of moving people off mainframes and AS/400 computers that are legacy systems into modern systems and into the cloud.
Well, I think that's great. I'm not sure everything is going into the cloud.
No, everything will not.
And meanwhile, we have all of these agencies, and yours is probably the biggest, I don't know. I was just complaining. Sorry. Yep.
Here, I have every right to complain. Yeah.
I think we share your
just get it off your chest.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'm going to support your item.
Any other questions?
Yes. Item 3, please.
Good morning, Mr. Comptroller. I have the finance director, Sherry Albert, available.
Thank you, Secretary Leahy. I believe, Governor, Madam Treasurer, we're being asked to approve a $19.7 million 8-year single bid contract to Overland Contracting in Garner, North Carolina, to replace our state's legacy emergency medical systems communications network. Obviously, it's an important contract. It means a lot to our first responders so that they can have some real-time communication with the emergency room and dispatch services for Medevac. But it's one of 5 single bid contracts in today's agenda. I guess the first question is, why was the only acceptable proposal submitted by a company from North Carolina?
Well, yes, sir. Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Governor, Mr. Comptroller. My name is Sherry Albin. I'm the finance director, and I am the procurement officer on this contract. Initially, MIMS was able to publish an RFP in August of 2016. Even though we have limited market to which we could appeal for this complex project, we issued the RFP. We had a lot of folks show up at our pre-bid conference. We went through eMaryland Marketplace. We received one offer. So we consulted with our partners at Do It, at the BPW, and were advised, and we wanted to do this as well, to cancel that RFP. We went out again. We cast a wider net. I appealed to over 359 vendors on eMaryland Marketplace. I appealed to 11 directors solicited directly, 11 vendors, potential vendors directly, and we were able to secure two offers. One of the offers was deemed technically not susceptible to award. And that's because they did not meet mandatory requirements. We extensively did a deep dive into the technical offer that Overland Contracting made to us. They do have a location here in Maryland, in Columbia. And we feel that they truly brought their A-team. And we feel very confident and with the hopeful that you will approve the award of this contract to Overland.
Okay. Have you, did the person you want us to award the contract, the company, have they ever done a project of this scale?
Yes, sir, they have.
Where?
They did more, I guess, more similar to our project. They did Pennsylvania State Police Communications Network. They did San Diego Power. And they also did Nevada Power, which is a system, again, of microwaves and emergency communications for these large areas jurisdictions. But Pennsylvania was the public safety one.
But I understand they only did some component parts in Pennsylvania.
Well, sir,
this contract.
We've hired them as a system integrator.
That's my concern, that they haven't done this before in a way that is anywhere near what we're asking them to do. And I just find it troubling. A, it's a single bid contract, and B, it reminds me of a famous old chestnut that was here before our board years ago, before this governor was ever governor, called Crystal Enterprises. We had the same situation. We hired them. They completely messed up because they've never really done the kind of job that was we were asking them to do. We had to go back and repair a whole bunch of problems that were created because of them. So I don't think we can afford to get it wrong in this area, which is first responders. So I'd like to defer this contract for 2 weeks and ask some more questions about whether this vendor you're proposing to us is capable of doing the job.
Can I just add that there are some critical time frames that we are facing? Rich Berg is our Director of Communications Engineering Services, and we are facing, I'm going to let Rich speak to this, but Verizon is taking away the copper lines.
So our current system is analog.
Can you step to the mic, please?
I'm sorry.
Our current system is analog-based, developed in the early 90s using technology that mainly came from the 80s. It relies a lot on Verizon lease circuits, special RTNV circuits. We received a notice in December of this last year that Verizon had been given permission by the Public Service Commission to start eliminating copper. That will begin December of 2018. So time is of the essence to get the system up to where it needs to be. So that's one of the deadlines.
Done that.
That was planned.
As my wife says, what is that? I don't know. It just popped up on the screen.
That was planned, Epic.
Yeah.
So we had that deadline that was not foreseen at the time that we originally released the RFP. But one of the things that I can point out, the equipment we currently use is 20 years old. We had an outage of one of the key core components on this past Thursday, 8 hours. Fortunately, we had pieces of a backup phone system that we could rely on. There are other core components of the current EMS system. There are no backups. And like I said, the existing equipment that we rely on each and every day is 20 years old. technology goes in the 80s and 90s. And it is imperative for us to move beyond these analog technologies, get to the IP-based, get to where we're more robust in our system.
So the urgency here, obviously we want the system to work, but it does work somewhat in a creaking way right now. Right now, yeah.
That is correct.
I have no problem with replacing it. I just want to have competitive bids, number one. And number two, I'd like to place a call to Verizon and ask them, based on the importance of this, whatever it is that they are pulling out that is made of copper from the system, that they defer on. And I'm happy to send a letter to the Public Service Commission saying you need to get 6 extra months in here so we can get, A, a competitive bid, and B, some confidence that this company, which you are asking us to award almost a $20 million contract, can do the job. Because I don't get that sense from the background material that they've done anything like this around the country.
Excuse me, sir. I do have...
Can you please get back to the microphone? Because it'll be recorded.
I'm sorry. I do have representatives from Overland Contracting here. If you would like them to speak in this forum to their capabilities.
Why don't we do it offline if my colleagues were willing to defer it for 2 weeks? Well, I'm happy to meet with
part of the problem is we don't have a Board of Public Works in 2 weeks. Our next meeting is June 20th, which is 5 weeks from now. And maybe you can address, you said it would be a concern to delay for 2 weeks, but it would really be five. And what is the critical time here? That what's going to happen?
December 2018, Verizon will start disconnecting our special circuits in the Montgomery County area, Towson area, and Glen Burnie areas. That will directly impact our ability to provide the life-saving communications to the field providers. We are looking at methods to fill in the gap, but we don't have those identified yet. And this is something.
Have you asked them not to do it?
So we have not directly asked Verizon to discontinue the plans. I do know Verizon is set to do it. They have the permission from the Public Service Commission to do it. We certainly can ask them. I'm not sure that will impact them. I mean, they have a lot of manpower and dollars waiting to make that transition. And I can't
really
speak to
that. The problem is that the Public Service Commission is a completely autonomous and independent agency who also doesn't meet for probably at least a month and already voted to give them the right to do it. So it's questionable whether we can reverse that.
Can I just, from my perspective, we were very concerned the first time. And you went out and redid everything and rebid it, and we're still where we are. I don't know any reason to think it would be different if we went out again. So that aspect, I think you've done fairly well. The other, I would like to have a little reassurance, because this is such an important, critical project. What made you think that this bidder was going to be able to do it up to your specifications?
From a technology perspective, we not only looked at the proposal, we looked at demonstrations of their capabilities in a small microcosm, but we saw those capabilities. And I'm confident that technology-wise, they'll be able to replace our current system with an IP-based system that meets or exceeds, and that was our goal, meet or exceed our current system.
Maybe we should take a moment to have the potential contractor come up and talk a little bit about their qualifications. I mean, this is obviously a very important public safety and public health communications upgrade, and I don't want to have the system collapse over this. I share the comptroller's concern that we only had the single bid, but I know you tried really hard to get an additional bid.
Thank you. We did. And we also did a thorough interview of their customers. But I'd like to present Preeti Pellapakkam and Gene Robinson with Overland Contracting.
Thank you. Welcome.
Sure. Good morning.
Morning.
So specifically with respect to capabilities, we are with Black & Veatch, which is the parent company of Overland Contracting. Black & Veatch is probably a more well-known brand in terms of engineering. We not only serve public safety, we also serve water and power, and we have a full portfolio of projects just within the state of Maryland. So in terms of this particular project for a public safety project, we are serving the role of system integrator. The main thing, I was deeply involved in putting this team together, and I come from a legacy of working in the public safety space for 15 years, and Gene here is the project manager. He's been working in the space for over 20 years. We both have worked for the major brands within the public safety space. I put a lot of emphasis on picking the right companies in terms of technology, as well as the right partners, the MBE partner. We made sure that we have 20% of the project, the SBE partner for the services, as well as the solutions come from companies like Nokia, Cisco. All of them are top-tier brands. So in terms of the technical capabilities and making sure that this project will exceed what we have currently in place, I'm very confident.
Thank you. Hi,
I'm Gene Robinson. And from a project management perspective, as far as rolling out the projects and that, Black & Veatch is, of the last 9 years, 8 years in a row, we've been rated the number one telecommunication services provider by Engineering News and Record. We've got a litany of experience AT&T rollouts across the country. We're one of their largest vendors. We do the wireline and wireless side of the business. On the utility side, we'll have large statewide contracts, microwave and land mobile radio contracts with like Nevada Shared Radio System, which is actually three agencies. There's NDOT, Nevada Energy, and Washoe County. So this is what we do. Specifically for me, a project you guys might be familiar with is Virginia Stars Project. So I was the project manager on that for the design and deployment of that system. So we, working with, a large, M-brand company, been through this stuff, doing large statewide rollouts, national rollouts from a cellular perspective and that. So from a radio and microwave perspective, we as a company have all of that, and that's what we do all day long, every day.
Okay. If I could just, so the contract is with Overland Contracting?
Yeah, so Overland Contracting, Black & Veatch owns Overland Contracting. It's one of our contracting
So who
companies.
Is doing the work, Overland Contracting?
So the work will come from a combination of the engineering services, will be Black & Veatch employees, and the field implementation manager. The reason we use Overland Contracting, anytime climbing a tower is involved, which will be in these cases for installing the microwave dishes, the antennas that go on it, we have to use our construction entity purely from an insurance and liability standpoint. So the contracting paperwork has to go through Overland Contracting. But in terms of the actual staffing of the project, it will be a combination of Black & Veatch and Overland Contracting, along with the companies I named, Nokia, Cisco, all these subcontracting entities.
Okay, and you've done these kinds of contracts in other states?
Oh, yes.
What are a couple of those states?
For me?
What are a couple? The STARS project, I'm not familiar with the acronym. What does that stand for?
It's the Virginia system, but that's Gene's
experience.
That is not a Black & Veatch project. But in terms of specifically Black & Veatch projects, we have Oregon, ODOT.
Oregon?
State of Oregon, yes.
Mm-hmm. What is that, public safety? Or?
Yes, okay. Public safety is on the system, yes.
What else?
We have Houston Galveston. Mm-hmm. So it's a consortium of multiple counties and cities that came together in that area. Right now, we are overseeing the entire city and county of Dallas that's going on. They are getting ready to start that project. We have pretty much any region you can take. We have either a statewide or a consortium of counties and cities that have come together.
In public safety?
Yes.
Okay. And were those contracts, did you compete competitively for them?
To win them, yes.
Yes. And there was competition?
Of course.
Yeah. could you please come forward, the procurement person again, and just help me understand why there can be competition in Dallas, Texas, and Oregon, and every other state where this big company does business, but we don't have any competition here?
Well, sir, the only thing I can think to appeal to that is the fact that Maryland has a very Maryland is a unique EMS system. Other states don't have the system that Maryland does.
Well, obviously, I don't have the support necessarily. I don't have actually a vote here, but if I did,
how do you know?
I would love to put this on, and because this is just classic defense of single bid process, and I just don't buy it. I'd almost rather have new procurement people involved in this. If the current procurement people come before us and say we tried our damnedest to get somebody in addition to the vendor we're asking you to award a $20 million contract to for a crucial activity, we tried and we could not get a second bid. That is unacceptable. I could get a second bid, and I'm not a procurement officer. I mean, just talk to them. They have a long list of people they compete with around the country. Yet here we are.
I appreciate your concern, sir, but I feel that MIMS did everything we could to encourage competition.
Okay. Well, thank you. I totally share the concern over single bid contracts, but I'm also well aware that this is a critical public safety and public health concern, and this emergency communications network is critical. I'm also convinced that proposed vendor is has the capabilities, and I'm going to vote for the bid of the contract. So I don't know if you...
Okay. No, I'd just like to be registered as opposed to it. Okay.
So we'll pull this out
for... single bid, Governor. Yes. Based on this, I don't mean to pick on you or your agency, but I'm going to pick on anybody that I can get my hands on until this situation with single bids is reduced even more than it is.
Sure. Thank you for raising the concerns. But so there's a motion
to approve this item separately.
Yeah, so we're going to pull this item out. I move
right.
We approve.
To approve 3IT separately. Is there a second?
Second. The motion carries 2-1.
2-1, okay. And then you've got the balance of the IT.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and
Thank
gentlemen.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on information technology? It's a motion. Second. 3-0 on the remainder of the...
Thank you.
We're going to move on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor and Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Pete Ron. I'm the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Transportation. Before I tell you how many items we have, I do want to mention that Mr. Quinn was up along with quite a few members of the department overnight because of the flash floods that took place in western Maryland, in which on the Brunswick line we had three trains that were stopped. One of them stopped in 4 foot of water and had to wait until the water could get low enough that they could actually walk through it and make sure that a culvert was not out. And so they accomplished that. The two trains behind them, which were the last trains to West Virginia, were stalled and essentially parked. And so we utilized local transit options available, as well as our commuter bus, to get our passengers, which there were a couple hundred of them, back out to the west side. Certainly the first group that was stuck in 4 foot of water understood why they weren't moving. I doubt that the other two trains knew why they were just sitting. But we did get them home, but 3 to 4 hour delay in getting them there. But we stuck to it. Mr. Quinn and his crew stuck to it, got everybody safely back home, just late.
Well, again, Mr. Quinn... lot of frustrated people, but thanks for the staying up all night and making sure they got to where they needed to get to. We don't really control the weather, or we haven't been in, you know, can't fix all the problems from 30 years ago, but we're working on it.
This was significant.
We had significant flooding all around the state, and that was probably the worst situation we had to deal with, so thank you.
Governor, could I just put, I know Secretary Grumbles has left, but as you know, he chairs your Maryland Climate Change Commission, and Secretary Belton is a major part of that. The Department of Transportation, Department of Health, Department of Agriculture. I don't know if this was due to climate change, but I do know that our weather is getting more volatile, and because of the change in heat in the atmosphere, you're seeing more of these storms come together, and they are playing off an old infrastructure and creating what we now call nuisance floods, a term that didn't even exist a decade ago, where, like in Frederick, just like in Howard County, they're not our system wasn't created for something like this. The water doesn't go down the drains the way as swiftly as it used to, and it results in flooding and problems. Every state faces this. But I think the work that is being done in that in your department and in your department and the Secretary's department coming together in terms of adaptation of our infrastructure is really very, very important. People do not yet connect the need to do adaptation work with this sort of event. But I think that's exactly what it is. And I commend you and hope we can work together to do sort of an educational job, too, to make people aware of this.
It's a serious issue, and one that we've been really focused on. There's no greater example than Ellicott City, where we had significant damage from the flood, but they've rebuilt the better standards, and hopefully we'll be able to handle these things a little better the next time we come around.
Take off on a tangent, but I just needed to mention that the department has 25 items today, and at the time the department is withdrawing 7 AE.
Okay.
And we will bring that back at a later time.
We have a couple of folks signed up to speak on item 2. We also have the Executive Director of the Maryland Aviation Commission, Mr. Smith, is here. So I'm going to let him present the item that's before us, and then we'll go to the speakers that want to comment or raise questions on it.
Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
It's always a pleasure. Good to see you again. About a year ago, we came to the board and asked for approval to extend our taxi contract for a year to address an issue with the finances of the contract. And that was a symptom of what is a very complex environment that our taxi program exists in. The emergence of TNCs, transportation network companies, Uber and Lyft, is making it very difficult for other ground transportation service providers like our taxi program to continue to perform at a higher level. As a matter of fact, over the last couple of years, taxi trips are down over 80,000 trips per year. Okay, so that's a significant drop off at the airport. So that's a significant drop off. The existing contract expires soon, and so we wanted to launch the procurement process to get a new contract. And as we were going through that whole process, that which was an information for bid approach, we thought that we would hear from our taxi drivers. And so in November, we hosted two meetings with the taxi drivers, and I think almost every taxi driver participated in one of those meetings. Some participated in both. But we had standing room only. It was a very productive set of meetings, got enormous feedback, very orderly. If I had to do it all over again, I would do the meetings again because they were very beneficial. We got some feedback from the drivers that compelled us to rethink the procurement. So instead of doing an information for bid, we decided to do an RFP, which would allow us the flexibility to address some of the concerns that they raised. And the concerns they raised were across the board. Some of them were labor-related, which we simply cannot involve ourselves in labor disputes or personnel issues, but others were more operational, And those we thought we could address. We also thought that we could do an RFP that would compel the proposers to speak to us about their approach to management. Okay? And so all of that is in this new RFP. Because of the time we spent redoing the procurement document, we now need a six-month extension to the contract because the existing contract expires before we can award a new contract. There's some concern on the part of the taxi drivers that they would have to live in the conditions that they say they're living in or operating in for another 6 months. Because of that concern, I met with them again. At least one group that comports itself to be the leader of the taxi coalition. Another productive meeting, but an outcome of that meeting was the proposal of a Bill of Rights, which in essence suggests that that the airport involves itself in labor matters related to the contract management and the drivers. We're a landlord. We can't involve ourselves in labor matters. There are other agencies that are responsible for adjudicating those kinds of disputes. And so I think you're probably going to hear some of that today from those representatives. But we think we prepared a procurement that will go a long way in addressing many of the concerns that they've raised over the years, and will continue to maintain a taxi program, which I think is one of the best in the country. We certainly have many of the best drivers in the state, if not the country. And we just want to create a contract that allows them to thrive and provide the kind of service that our customers expect, while allowing management to have a contract that makes a little bit of money for them. And so that's what we're proposing. And I make myself available for whatever questions you might have.
I have a question of Ricky, but I don't know whether it's now or after.
You can ask him now, and then we can move on to him.
Okay. Well, I think that your new proposal does incorporate a lot of the changes that we know were desired and appreciate that very much. Mm-hmm. The argument regarding the Bill of Rights or whatever you call it, your argument that you can't get involved with that because that's between the management and the taxi cab drivers, assuming you have this management model.
Yes.
But doesn't that depend on the RFP and the contract? I mean, can't you put provisions in your RFP that inserts things like that? I understand you can't do it now, but you're going to have a new regime.
So, Madam Treasurer, very good question. The RFP that is on the street now for consideration does include measures that will require any proposer to propose to us what management approaches they will take to address many of the issues that the drivers have brought to us. Again, we can include it in the RFP, and when they propose it, if we pick that firm, any proposal that they include in their offer to us becomes a part of the contract.
Right.
That gives us some contract authority to address management issues. However, it still does not give us the authority to address personnel issues or labor disputes. Those are matters that, again, have to be adjudicated.
Well, I don't know what the taxi cab driver's Bill of Rights is, so
yes.
I'm at a complete disadvantage here.
I think what Mr. Smith is saying that, in the RFP and in the awarding of a bid, we can address some of those issues, but we can't just ignore the owners or the management of the group and tell them what they, how they run their.
Well, I understand there's certain internal management things you wouldn't want to get involved in, because that's micromanagement. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, setting out standards, mm-hmm. you clearly would want to get in a new regime.
Treasurer, for example.
But I don't know what they.
For example, one of the complaints was that the staff person for the taxi stand is unprofessional. So we're requiring them to propose to us what qualifications they will set out for that staff person. Those are the kinds of requirements that we typically include in RFPs for services. And we're now adding those to the standards, exactly. Yes.
May I?
Secretary Ron.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Governor. Madam Treasurer, another way to view this is more than just, in my opinion, as a landlord, but we are
contracting for services the same as we do with SHA or any of our other business units. And so our relationship is between the contractor and us and the contract. Their relationship with their subcontractors is between them and their subs.
I get that, but the contract between the new contract between you and the manager can have whatever provisions you and the manager can agree to.
An example would be within our contracts, we don't demand that union labor be used as an example.
That's your policy.
The contractor,
that's law.
Right? So the contractor, though, has made a decision about whether their workforce is union or non or whatever. And so, it just gets so messy, frankly, when you try to get beyond that.
Life is difficult, and I understand once you have a contract, you don't violate the contract. And I understand you don't want to get into micromanagement. Mm-hmm. What I don't understand, and maybe we'll hear, is what those standards, what is needed beyond, if anything, the standards that you could put in place in the contract to meet valid objections. I think your response was a good one.
Okay. Madam Treasurer, when we contract a company to manage the taxi program, we're expecting them to bring certain competencies, including management competencies, that would not require MAA to be involved in managing its subcontractors or its workforce.
Yes.
In this RFP process, we're asking them to communicate to us what those competencies are, what those qualifications are, what those standards are, and that will be a part of our evaluation process. If they can't demonstrate to us that they can effectively manage the taxi subcontractors, then they won't get the right scores, and so they won't be awarded the contract.
And again, I don't know what the specifics are.
Maybe
what you say in general makes a lot of sense.
Maybe we could ask you to stand by in case we have other questions that you can address, and we'll move on to let the speakers signed up.
Okay.
Thank you. Now we will have Aurora Vasquez and Luis Tirigal.
Good morning. My name is Luis Trigal. I have been a taxi cab driver for the last 21 years at BWI Airport. I'm also a member of the leadership of the Taxi Cab Coalition. We are a cab driver group, and our goal is to improve the working conditions of the BWI taxi drivers. On behalf of the coalition, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak here today and voice our concerns. Our main concern is actually the extension of 6 months of this contract. Why? Because of the way that the management company has been treating the taxi drivers. Especially since we began to try to improve our working conditions after the extension granted on June the 7th in a meeting like this. Specifically, when that was granted, since that moment, we have been subject to extreme punishment, even for minor violations, that we can prove we have a pile that, you know, there's not going to be all the time in the world to show, but we'd be glad to submit it. Sometimes these violations didn't even happen. The MAA has made it clear to us that they will not intervene or interfere in the company policies towards the drivers. We think this is unfair. Our jobs are at risk. Threats of termination all the time, even though the company hasn't terminated. But the risk is there. It's like having a gun to your head. They don't need to kill you for you to be afraid all the time. We tried to set up a meeting with the company first, the company owner, to incorporate the cab driver bill of rights, which, by the way, is very simple. It's a 3-page document that I'd be glad to give you copies of. No success with the meeting. We engaged the services of a mediator. No response either for the last 45 days. Company refused to meet. If there is an extension, because we understand that the MIA is in the process of selecting a company, obviously an extension must be granted, because there has to be a company management service. That is obvious. What we are here to ask you is to consider our Bill of Rights, which is nothing less and nothing more than an assurance of the fair treatment of the VWI drivers. Very simple. Due process. What is that? From the moment that a complaint comes against the driver, no matter where it comes from, whether a patron, a dispatcher, another driver, that driver has the opportunity to defend himself, that the company produced the evidence that what the driver is accused of, that violation that he's supposed to have occurred, and that he would be given time to respond before action is taken. Disciplinary action, which, by the way, it causes economic mayhem, because there are suspensions all the time, depriving the drivers of their revenue. And sometimes these are accusations and punishments of violations that later on are proven wrong, that the driver was not at fault. Faced with this, the company or the manager said, well, too bad. C'est la vie. They took a couple of days off, and I hope your rest is fine. Is that it? Let me give you an example. On March the 21st, we had a very severe snowstorm in the state. Between 6 and 8 inches of snow, if I remember correctly. Snow emergency procedures, pardon me, were implemented by the state police in Anne Arundel County. There is a provision in the Anne Arundel County, from the Anne Arundel County Taxi Cab Division, and it's been happening for decades. I've been here 20 years. My co-workers have been here 39. Every time that the Anne Arundel is under these snow emergency procedures, the taxi cab drivers are allowed a surcharge of 25%. Those days, of course, I don't have to tell you how difficult things are on the road. We've been the only ones at BWI, the only ones, means of transportation. For the first time this year, the company did not allow it. We asked the company. We were working 11 a.m., 12 a.m., 1 a.m. And the owner said no. We just later found out that the state police declared a state emergency, snow state emergency, for Anne Arundel County as of 10 a.m. We have the tweet. In many other instances, policies like company doesn't allow to blow the horn at the terminal. What is that? The horn is an element of safety. It's like asking someone, you cannot turn your signal at the terminal. It can save a life. It can warn of a danger. Still, the company said no harm determined. We understand that abuses can be committed, you know, but policy has to be written clearly. Drivers have received warnings about this, unnecessarily in our view. The list goes on and on and on and on. Again, we'd be glad to submit proof of this. And also the discrimination factor. Why? Because it just happens that many, 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 and most, actually, of these set examples or punishment are against coalition supporters or coalition leadership members. The statistics are astounding to be a coincidence. It's 87%. How do we know? Because we have been collecting them. Letters, etc. But that's why we are here to ask you, members of the board, to intercede for us and see if we could include the Bill of Rights, but not only in this 6 months extension, because that solves the problem until December the 31st. What if the next company has the same policies or worse? We don't know that. As it is in the RFP, it's a blank because that's what the RFP is, request for proposals. So we do not know at this point. I guess that at the end of the day, that is it. I hope I have been clear.
Well, thank you very much. I thank you.
And thank you again for...
I thank you for coming and representing many of the other drivers, and I think you make some excellent points. Now, Mr. Smith said that many of these concerns could be addressed with the awarding of a new contract to make sure that whoever the new company is has to abide by many of the things. Some of these things are obviously saying you have to violate the law doesn't make any sense at all.
Sure. Sure.
Those are things that we should be able to address. But sure. You're asking for the extension, we have to do the extension.
Yes.
Because it takes a while.
No,
we can address them in 6 months when the contract is awarded. But you're asking that for the extension of the 6 months that we somehow, and I'm not sure whether even legally, and we'll ask Mr. Smith to address, it's an extension of an existing contract that doesn't have those things in it,
sure.
How we can even do it. But we're going to try to get the answers to that.
And another thing is the suggestion of that if for any reason procurement, legal, out of my scope of knowledge, cannot be done in the MIA contract, it can be done in the company owner-operator contract. That will be satisfactory enough.
And you, just to be clear, I think you're independent contractors of the company,
yes,
not
we are.
Employees of the company.
Not at all.
So it changes how they interact.
No. We are owner-operators.
Right.
By the way, members of the board, we have submitted in September a 22-page proposal about a change in our business model, including some win-win solutions given our plummeting revenues due to the advent of the TNCs, Uber and Lyft. This is a worldwide phenomenon. It's nothing new for anyone. And I'm just going to mention one because this is too long, but your deputy is Mr. Newgan.
Actually, we would love to have a copy of the proposed taxi cab Bill of Rights. And
absolutely.
So we can all take a look.
Your deputies have them. The one that I'm going to mention probably, which is the win-win solution, is to allow the taxi drivers to get return trips.
To get what? I'm sorry.
Return trips.
Yeah.
The end of what's called the deadhead provision. We drop some, pick up somebody off at the airport, drop them off, whatever, and come back empty. A waste of time, gasoline, and revenue for the state, the company, and us. Why not? It has been done in Dallas Airport successfully. There may be jurisdictional problems, I understand, out of my scope, but we ask you to explore this, or to at least suggest the MAA to explore this. I know that a lot of work went into the RFP, but this could change the game in a positive way for everyone. Mm-hmm. Revenue is the word, I believe, and the taxi industry is under siege. This can resolve the problem for all of us.
Mr. Tiergo?
Yes, sir.
Is it true that you went to Harvard Law School?
That was my twin brother.
I was just going to say, very articulate.
He looks like me.
I thank the Treasurer for bringing the subject up, and obviously the Governor is interested in. I think we'll all take a look at it. I just don't think we can do anything right now.
Well, I really appreciate your advocacy, and you have been very articulate, but we still want to hear from your colleague there, Aurora. And then I'm going to have Mr. Smith. I have a couple of questions that you just raised that I want to get his answers to.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So good morning. My name is Aurora Vasquez. I am with the Excluded Worker Project, and I serve as the strategist to the coalition, which basically means that the cab drivers came to me with a concern, and I sat down and helped them brainstorm a way to find a solution, basically. And so I just wanted to touch on three things that were said to by Mr. Tirigal and one by Mr. Smith. With respect to the feeling of urgency cab drivers have around incorporating a Bill of Rights, that stems directly from the realities of their working environment. So it's not like they're asking for something extra because they have nothing better to do. They're really trying to find a solution so that they can continue to work under reasonable conditions. And we're talking about cab drivers who have been at the airport for many years, not 2 years, not a year, but people who have made a lifetime profession out of serving the airport. And they've invested a great deal of money in buying their cars. So these folks in the room at this point are actually owners of their vehicles. They're not renting a car. So there's some capital investment there also. Again, so who wouldn't want to work in a reasonable environment where you feel like you're both welcomed and like you can do your job without there being barriers? So that said, we've touched on some of the what is feeling like increased and pretty aggressive allegations of violations. And the dilemma cab drivers are in is that some of those are, cab drivers are being suspended if allegedly something happens, and the company doesn't always issue a written record of why the suspension happened. So it makes it even tough for cab drivers to try to resolve the situation when there's no record of it happening. So that's one point. The other point is that some of these letters are labeled as warning letters, but the language in them is much more serious than that. There's language in those letters that says things like, the next step is termination. So you issue a warning letter for somebody who honks in the terminal, and then that honking is described as a disturbance, and then the letter says the disturbance is cause for termination. So the idea that the company is being reasonable in an approach by issuing warning letters becomes less reasonable when you read the language and you see that it has this other language that says next stop for you is termination. Again, termination of people who've invested a great deal of money and a lifetime in serving the airport. The third thing I wanted to just give a note on is Mr. Smith's great explanation of the new approach from IFB to an RFP. We appreciate that he heard cab drivers and is trying to do something different. And at one point he mentioned that the folks who submit a bid, the firms who submit a bid, will have to identify their competencies. That's fabulous. The dilemma for us, the coalition, is that we won't actually, there isn't a mechanism for us to know what competencies they're identifying and whether those competencies will be different than the competencies the current management company identified, because my guess is the current management company was selected because they put some competencies on the table as well. But the RFP itself indicates that the qualifications to apply is prior taxicab ownership and management. And so that significantly narrows the pool of who's going to apply for this. And historically, both in this area, in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., but around the country, the approach to managing cab drivers by cab companies is very top-down and not at all unlike what is happening at the airport right now in terms of this relationship. So now you've narrowed your scope to people who have a history of interacting with cab drivers much like the current company does, So I suspect we will be in the same situation coming around, even when they identify competencies that technically qualify for them. Because there aren't very many CAD companies who are thinking creatively and in a modern way in terms of how to manage a body of workers who are also independent contractors. And so these conflicts arise because that nature of you're an independent contractor is often used against cab drivers as a mechanism to keep them quiet or have them not complain or ask for better working conditions. So I think it's helpful if we all keep that in mind, and if we can find a way to incorporate the Bill of Rights or concepts from it into the next contract, which we've looked at and is very much the language from the old way of doing things. There's nothing much new in the model contract. And if we could find a way to incorporate things into the six-month extension, if the management company would be so inclined to actually come to the table in earnest and talk about that Bill of Rights and adopting it for the six-month period, I think as a whole, as a totality, we'd all be in a much better place. And cab drivers would be much better able to provide quality service to BWI patrons without these sudden interruptions of sudden suspensions where you lose income for a day or two and there's no way to rectify that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Smith?
Yes,
yeah, I'm sorry.
About, yeah, about the Bill of Rights,
yes,
which I see we do have in backup. What's the derivation of that?
I'm sorry?
The derivation of
The concept of the Bill of Rights has come from a variety of cab driver-led industry reform efforts. I've been working with cab drivers since the early 2000s, doing taxi cab industry reform. And what we've done is we've structured bills of rights. So in New York City, for example, cab driver bill of rights is in place there. When we haven't been able to do it as a separate document like this, we've incorporated due process concepts into the actual regulations or any other policy that governs. It just so happens that here we did it separately as distinguished from, say, writing due process principles into a regulation or trying to convince somebody to change a law to incorporate it that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, could you come up back up for... Well, first of all, while he's coming up, I thought both of you, thank you. Thank you and the rest of the drivers for being here today and expressing these concerns. And Mr. Smith, I want to thank you. It seems as if you've done a lot of outreach to meet with all of the concerned drivers over and over again and have listened to some of their concerns. I mean, they make some very good points. I mean, I understand we cannot, without changing laws and regulations, we can't order one independent company to change their internal rules with another company. But we can set standards in the bids and the RFPs for the kinds of things that we can require under that contract, right? And some of these things could be addressed. In fact, many of them, I believe, because some of these things are dealing with things that we could provide standards for and require the bidder, right, to incorporate some of these concepts. And I know we can probably do that in the new RFP.
Sir, you're absolutely correct, and that's what we're trying to accomplish.
That's what you're trying to get done.
Yeah.
My question is on the extension, because we already have a contract that doesn't have those things. And it seems as you tell me, but I don't know whether to extend it for six. I don't know how we don't extend it for 6 months, but can we change the terms of a contract to do an extension? I just don't know the answer to that.
Governor, very good question, and like a very good point that was made. We would have to look at the items and the Bill of Rights and determine what kind of change we would have
to make.
Which
ones we could potentially.
Right. Some of those changes may be beyond the authority that we have. For example, the National Labor Relations Board has jurisdiction over perhaps some of the changes that they would want us to make. That would probably cause a need for another extension if we're going to make a change to this contract.
I'm not even sure how the National Labor Relations Board gets involved in subcontractors because they're not employees and it's not technically labor.
So they have a combination of subcontracted drivers and employees.
Oh, they have some employees as well.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
Can we hear from the company?
Pardon me?
Is the company here?
Yes, there is.
Great. Could we just hear, it's not a, I don't want it to go on for hours here, but if somebody could just respond to what the governor and the treasurer said, maybe we can make some progress and move forward.
I do want to address one point of clarification. There was a request that we allow the the drivers to handle both outbound and inbound passengers. When the closed system at the airport was approved by the Public Service Commission, it was approved as an exclusive arrangement at the airport. So off-airport taxi drivers cannot come to the airport and pick up a passenger unless it's prearranged. Because of that exclusivity, our taxi drivers are prohibited from picking up drivers and bringing them to the airport, again, unless it is prearranged. And the thinking there is that it would be unfair to off-airport taxi drivers if our taxi drivers are given an exclusive arrangement and then they're still allowed to compete with them off-airport. And so that was the reason why we pushed back on that request.
And that's an existing Public Service Commission decision?
Yes, it is, sir. Yes, sir.
But they make different decisions at Dulles, according to some of the drivers.
At Dulles is subject to a different ruling body, yes.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we'll have the company owner, if you'd like to come up and maybe just.
Good morning, board. Good morning, everybody. I'm not going to take too much time. I just respond to a few issues. Bill of Rights, the one they are talking about. I'm sorry. This is Sayed Esfarjani, owner of BWI Taxi Management. Bill of Rights. We already doing 95% of the Bill of Rights that coalition is talking about. The view is different. Our explanation is different. They want something else. The company policy is based on MAA requirement, AA County and company itself. We are committed to provide service to public, and that's all we are there. Drivers are contractors, and they are selecting this company to work with. We are not putting them under any pressure. Is their choice. About complaint, if the complaint comes from the public, we take it 100% serious. We call it external complaint. We have to answer MAA if we do not respond to the public. If public is not satisfied, the letter even going to come to your office, and we're going to be at default with the contract. We have to take care of the complaint. Internal complaint between drivers or staff is secondary part of our jobs. 25% snow emergency that the gentleman mentioned, yes, is required by AA County during snow emergency. But depends on the companies. We decided we're not going to implement that snow emergency due to the competition, Uber, Lyft, and others. Any customer will lose at any time. They will not longer come back to our service. I did not want during 4 hours or 10 hours snow emergency to lose those number of customers for the company. That was the reason we have explained to them it goes nowhere. The only problem company has with coalition, the coalition do not recognize answer no as a no. They don't understand meaning of no. If company cannot do it, we cannot do it. We are not enemy of these drivers. They are supporting company. They are supporting public. They give excellent service to public. I am glad we have this group of people. I'm glad they are talking about these issues. There are no place to be blamed for them. We do not take revenge. This absolutely lie, and that's not true. There is no revenge. But yes, if you are in terminal and mother and kids are walking, and you use your horn as a method of communication with the other driver, we're going to send them home. That's the only option we have. I cannot beat up the driver. The only thing I can do to the driver is send him home 24 hours. That's all I can. MAA requires driver to come into the terminal by having headlights on for safety issue. We put note. We give them 3 weeks warning. Still, there are drivers who do not want to do, or they forget. So we tell them we're going to send you home 24 hours. That's the only option we have. They do not like it. Discrimination. We have all kind of drivers. Some of these people who are against me today used to be my best friend. We do not discriminate. I have drivers who've been against company for years and years and years, and still they are working. When they have nothing to say, they bring discrimination. They wanted company to recognize their coalition. This coalition is not more than 40 people. We have 240 drivers. I have to be able to talk to both groups. I cannot take all of your idea and apply it to another 200 people. I have to be fair. I am fair, and our policy is fair, and I am disappointed from this group who are coming today, and they want to make the company look bad. And they are trying to make MAA look bad indirectly because they have something in their mind. They have some interest in mind that I do not know yet. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I have one driver who is begging to come here who is not a coalition member. Please allow him a few minutes to talk.
Sure. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Ray Oscuri. I've been about 18 years on BWI taxi as a driver. I had some issue with my health, cancer and heart attack. I was awake for a year or so. It's been back for a few months, and I have found out a group of between 18 to 28 people, not more than that, they try to represent 240 drivers. I have a problem with that. That's what I came in front of you. And today you're all talking about the Bill of Rights and other issues. This company has been providing service to the customers, to BWI Airport, to MAA, and the drivers. The drivers been working there 20, 30 years. They're feeding their family. They have a kid, house, in the school. If this company is not fair, how they survive all these years? Suddenly, when it comes the time for new contract, a group comes in and wants to discredit this. Whatever is being talked here, it does exist, Governor, and the rest of you, in the book, and the law book they have in the office. And it's been, and nobody gets mistreated. We do not believe these people. We do not prove these people, the group of 18 to 28. I think we need to have more drivers been involved on this issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have you read this Bill of Rights?
No, ma'am. I have not seen it. And I have asked for it. I have not seen it.
Okay.
Thank you. Look, I think, Mr. Smith, maybe you come up and say anything else that you want to close out. I want to thank everybody for being here. I want to thank you for getting everybody's input and having the multiple meetings. I want to thank the representatives of the group of concerned folks for being here. I want to thank the company. It sounds to me like there are some. I mean, these are a group of independent contractors, some of whom are not happy. That's a business issue for you to try to work out. I would encourage everybody to continue to have dialogue. I think we have to do this renewal of the six-month contract. If you can take some of the considerations and some of these things into consideration as we do a new contract, and the company can, the companies that are trying to participate can take them into consideration to help address some of these concerns, great. I don't believe we can dictate to private companies exactly what they do with their subcontractors without changing laws and regulations, but I think we can try to encourage, more cooperation and, I don't know if you have anything you'd like to say.
I agree 100%. I mean, we think the drivers are extremely important. We want them to be in an environment where they can be productive and they can provide good service to our customers. And we think this RFP process will go a long way in helping to address some of those concerns.
Any other?
I would just add, we do have copies of this Bill of Rights. I'm sure you do, too.
Yes.
I can understand why some parts are problematic, but an awful lot of it looks perfectly normal business, and I just urge you to look at it so that we will know what parts actually.
And it sounds like the owner of the company has no problem with much of that as well.
I would suggest that other than those that may be labor issues, there's nothing in the Bill of Rights that we don't think will be addressed during the RFP process.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions on the Department of Transportation agenda? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Thank you. Last but not least, we're going to move on to the Department of General Services.
Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Millington Churchill, Secretary for the Department of General Services. The department has 33 items on our agenda, including one supplemental. The department is withdrawing item 22 and 27, and we'll be glad to answer your questions at this time.
Questions on DGS? Fair motion. That concludes our Board of Public Works for today. Thank you.